Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Teruma. This week, Nachama Goldman Barash discusses Teruma. Nachama Goldman Barash is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Nachama Goldman Barash.
Parsha Teruma comes after the Torah has been given at Mount Sinai and after Parashat Mishpatim has been read, which is the first exposure to the legal system we will later call Halacha. In the Parsha, in this week's Parsha, we have a detailed description of the building of the tabernacle, which will be repeated as well in the last two portions of Shemot, Vayakel and Pekudei, which are read after the sin of the golden calf in Kitisa. In other words, Teruma and Tetzava come before the sin of the golden calf, and Vayakel and Pekudei come after the sin of the golden calf, and all four portions deal with subject matter related to the building specifications of the tabernacle, the clothing of the priests, and the overall presence of the tabernacle in the camp. One of the major questions that arises in the commentaries around this portion is whether the physical space, the tabernacle and its physical space with its opulence and its precise dimension and its sacrifices represents an ideal framework for worship or a de facto framework as a result of the sin of the golden calf. It is possible to understand the reasoning in both directions. The sin of the golden calf revealed an intense need on the part of the people to have some sort of manifestation of the divine in their midst in order to have a focal point for their worship. The tabernacle, with all of its gilded accessories and rich fabrics, provides such a framework, but it is seen as a concession to the weakness of human need for physicality. On the other hand, given the milieu of the ancient Near East with its temples and sacrifices, perhaps, as with many other parallel commandments, for instance circumcision, which was a known ritual in the ancient Near East, but was directed differently in the Jewish religion, this was God's way of reinforcing the chosenness of his people by opening a similar vehicle for worship, but towards one God. The tabernacle, for instance, was singular. There were no other options for sacrificial worship, and in this way, tightly contained and overseen by Moses and Aaron and his sons. The earthly residence would mirror the heavenly prototype in which God was presumed to dwell. One God, one residence. Let's take a look at our parsha. The portion opens, and God spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the Israelite people to bring me gifts. You shall accept gifts for me from every person whose heart is so moved, and let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." I've actually not read the verses chronologically. I excerpted the last piece about creating a sanctuary that I may dwell among them from a later verse. But the idea is that there will be some sort of partnership in which the children of Israel will bring gifts in order to build the tabernacle. And in that sense, God will come into the tabernacle and dwell among them after they have built it. There are a number of midrashim I would like to share that reflect the relationship between God and Israel as manifested in the tabernacle. The metaphor of father and daughter is explored. While the father is always God, the daughter is either the children of Israel or, interestingly, the Torah. The first midrash is from Song of Songs, Rabbah 3:9. King Solomon made himself a palanquin, or in the Greek, it's the apirion. Rav Azariah, in the name of Rav Judah ben Simon, interpreted the verse as applying to the tabernacle. In other words, don't read this as King Solomon making himself a palanquin, but let's look at the palanquin, which is a kind of a place of dwelling. Let's look at it as the tabernacle. The palanquin refers to the tabernacle, says the Midrash, said Rabbi Yehuda ben Rabbi Eli. It is as if a king had a young daughter, and before she grew up and reached maturity, he used to see her in the street and speak to her in public, in an alleyway or in a courtyard. But after she grew up and reached maturity, he said, "It is not becoming for my daughter that I should converse with her in public. Make her therefore a pavilion, and when I need to converse with her, I will do so within the pavilion." That's the mashal, that's the parable of the king recognizing differences in the stage of maturity with his daughter and that the relationship has to change. The nimshal, or the message of the parable, which is a known device in Midrashic literature, is as follows. So it is written, "When Israel was a child, then I loved him. In Egypt, the Israelites saw God in the open. At the Red Sea, they saw him in the open. At Sinai, they saw him face to face and said, 'All that the Lord has spoken, we will do and we will obey.'" and they had become a whole nation. And the Holy One, blessed be He, said, it is not becoming for my people that I should speak with them in the open. Let them therefore make for me a tabernacle, and whenever I need to speak with them, I shall speak with them from the midst of the tabernacle. In this very rich metaphor, the author distinguishes between the relationship a father has with his daughter before and after sexual maturity. In rabbinic halachic literature, the father is responsible for caring for his daughter until puberty. She becomes a legal adult at 12 and a half, according to Jewish law, and is meant to be married off. In the parable, however, the author does not reflect on how marriage changes the relationship between father and daughter. That will be explored in the next midrash I bring. Here, however, is the idea that sexual maturity changes the relationship regardless of whether she gets married or not. While in the beginning, while the daughter is a child, the king would engage with the daughter whenever and whenever they would meet. The child needs constant encouragement, tangible expressions of love, and reinforcement of that love with each encounter. At sexual puberty, however, the king does not want to relinquish the relationship, but recognizes that his has changed. His daughter is a legal adult. She is of marriageable age. It is no longer appropriate for him to greet her and embrace her publicly. But he does not want to lose all contact with her, and he creates a private space where they can meet and preserve the closeness and intimacy of the relationship. This is then applied to the evolving relationship with Yisrael, with Israel. It cannot remain in its initial stages of grand gestures and miracles and revelation. There must be a diminishing of God's presence to allow for the daughter, meaning the nation, to grow without the all-seeing, all-knowing eye of the Father, meaning God, in direct view. The Midrash suggested this is a healthier and longer-lasting model for closeness, similar to the shift that happens as a child grows into adult. The tabernacle is the medium in which this relationship can be fostered and maintained. The next Midrash I want to bring is from Exodus Rabbah 33:1. And this is the offering you shall take, V'yikhuli truma, that's straight from our Parsha, as it is written, for I give you good doctrine, forsake not my Torah. God, however, said to Israel, I have sold you my Torah, but with it, as it were, I have also been sold, as it says that they take from me an offering, which is from our portion as well. So first of all, I just want to comment on the opening lines of this Midrash, this idea that God has sold us the Torah. It's a very powerful metaphor, because of course, when a seller sells to a buyer, he relinquishes total control over the object that he has sold and now belongs completely to the one who bought it. So already in the opening, the Midrash suggests something that's astonishing, that God has not only given us the Torah, but he has given us absolute control over the Torah. It belonged to God, and now he sold it. Question is, what is the currency? To the children of Israel, and now it completely belongs to them. Let's see how the Midrash continues. It can be compared to a king whose only daughter married another king. When he wished to return to his country and take his wife with him, he said to him, my daughter, whose hand I have given you, is my only child. I cannot part from her. Neither can I say to you, do not take her, for she now is your wife. This favor, however, I would request of you. Wherever you go to live, have a chamber ready for me, that I may dwell with you, for I cannot leave my daughter. Thus God said to Israel, I have given you a Torah from which I cannot part, and I also cannot tell you not to take it. But this I would request, wherever you go, make for me a house wherein I may live. As it says, Exodus 22:8, and let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them. This Midrash uses the father-daughter model in an even more unusual way. In this Midrash, the vulnerability of the father is emphasized. The daughter is about to be married to another king, which is the way of the world, and what a father would want for his only daughter. Not only that, the father has had control over whom he marries her off to. He has chosen another king. Marrying her off ensures her protection and continuity. However, a daughter once married now belongs to her husband, and her husband is returning to his country, which will result in great separation from the father. The king, who is now the son-in-law, was once the equal of the father. Now he is his superior in one significant way. He has claim to the daughter, now his wife, and the father, if he wishes to maintain this relationship with his only daughter, is at the mercy of his colleague, now his son-in-law. He puts in his plea. He desperately wants to stay close with his daughter. He cannot stop his son-in-law taking his daughter away from him. He asks only for a chamber in which he can dwell with them so that he not be separated. It will be an act of mercy, hopefully also of love as well, for the king towards his wife, maybe also towards his father-in-law, if the son-in-law acquiesces. The request is made. The answer lies in the hand of the fellow king. The message to the parable is clear. God gives the Torah to the children of Israel. This is an amazing comparison. The children of Israel are the king who becomes the son-in-law. God is their partner, and then God is at their mercy when he gives them his daughter, the Torah. In other words, the Torah can only be made public in the world if God partners with someone. And he chooses the children of Israel to partner with so that the Torah is ensured, its continuity is ensured, its protection is ensured. It can't stay in the hands of God or it will go nowhere. So he has to trust his fellow king, his partner, the children of Israel, to protect and ensure the stability and the future of his daughter, meaning the Torah. The daughter and the son-in-law can choose to, the message. God is at the mercy of the children of Israel when he gives them his daughter, the Torah. They can choose to include God in this marriage or exclude him. The Torah, like the daughter, now belongs to the children of Israel. Bringing God into their lives of Torah is at their jurisdiction. God's vulnerability is exposed. He asked to dwell among them so that he can remain close to his beloved Torah and not be forgotten by the children of Israel when they depart Sinai. The author of this midrash foresees the modern era in biblical criticism, which is able to strip the Torah of divinity. God pleads to be kept close to his beloved Torah and by extension, the children of Israel. It is up to the children of Israel to decide what the relationship will look like. The final midrash we will look at is in Leviticus Rabbah 30:13, and it also plays with the vulnerability of God once the Torah has been given and the tabernacle built. The midrash reads as follows. I said to them, God said to them, and you shall take from me an offering so that I may dwell with you, and you shall make me a mikdash, a temple. And it is if to say that the Holy One, blessed be he, said, take me, and I will dwell among you. It is not written, take an offering, but rather, vayikhu li, take me. Oti atem lokhim, it is me that you are taking. I am the offering. This plays with the vulnerability of God once the Torah has been given and the tabernacle built, as we suggested. In this reading of the text, God asks not for an offering to build the tabernacle, but that he be taken as the offering when building the tabernacle. Again, the author seems to recognize that the tabernacle can be built and left devoid of God's presence unless we as a nation consciously bring him into our worship. I would like to conclude with an idea from the modern biblical scholar Umberto Casuto. We must realize that the children of Israel, after they had been privileged to witness the revelation of God at Mount Sinai, were about to journey from there, and thus draw away from the sight of theophany. So long as they were encamped in the place, they were conscious of God's nearness. But once they set out on their journey, it seemed to them as though the link had been broken, unless there were in their midst a tangible symbol of God's presence among them. It was the function of the tabernacle to serve as such a symbol. Not without reason, therefore, does this section come immediately after the section that describes the making of the covenant and Mount Sinai. The nexus between Israel and the tabernacle is a perpetual extension of the bond that was forged at Sinai between the people and their God. This is the significance of the clear parallelism between the last sentences of the preceding section describing how the divine presence dwelt upon Mount Sinai and the closing passage of our book, which depicts in like terms how the divine presence abode in the tabernacle. The very design of the tabernacle was able to inspire the people with the confident feeling that the Lord was present in their midst. End quote. We have not had the tabernacle or the temple for 2,000 years, and yet we have managed to maintain, foster, and nurture this relationship through communal structures such as Beit Knesset, synagogue, and Beit Midrash, houses of study, and through personal structures within the family and the home and the study of prayer and Torah. Without a deliberate choosing to bring God into our rituals, prayers, and study, God and his people would be distanced and remote from one another. This parsha, with its wonderful midrashim, teaches us that, to paraphrase Avram Heschel, while we are in search of God, most revealingly, God is also constantly in search of us. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Nechama. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.